Hello, thank you for downloading this podcast of the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. We hope you enjoy listening to this. For more information about our programs, please visit www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.
Distinguished Philosopher in Residence, which was an invitation that came to me completely out of the blue. And I've never been to this part of the world before, so I'm really happy to be. I mean, it's a beautiful city and a beautiful campus, so I'm delighted to be here, humbled and grateful for the opportunity. And so I'm happy to be able to publicly thank Professor Silberstein and Professor Kwan, who did a lot of organizational details, but I know there were people behind the scenes and funds from the Institute, which also helped to get me here, helped me to come. So the lecture is entitled Territory and Self-Determination, and it draws, and mostly I'm going to talk about how we haven't thought about territory very much and how we need to think about territory, so the subtitle is important. And the slide invites us, actually even the earlier promotional slide, invites us to reflect on the fact that almost the entire usable surface of the Earth, of our planet, is divided into territorially distinct jurisdictional units. It's into different territories. And that's not only true of land surfaces, but territorial units in international law extend right down to the core of the Earth. States claim jurisdiction over airspace. They charge airplanes for going through airspace. They defend airspace. It's part of their territory. And of course, there's extensions of territory into the oceans, too. So we have to think. So territory is an important principle and of organization of our world. And so we should think about it. We should think about what justifies it, what justifies territory is related to other values which we might think also should undergird a morally acceptable institutional order. So what I'm first going to do is argue that we haven't thought very much about it. And when I first started being interested in territory, I would say to people, oh, I'm going to work on territory. And people would send me little bits of pieces. You know, like Grotius said this, but there was actually not very much written on territory, and mostly because it was hard to work on something pretty new. But I had a lot of help, but if you think about it, many of our disputes in the world are territorial disputes. They're disputes about when two or more peoples or states claim the same piece of land. Or they could be border disputes where it's not a whole land, but actually how the border is drawn can be in dispute. Canada has a dispute with Denmark around Greenland, which looks just like a cartographic border dispute. And we also have cases of, say, secession, where a group is claiming a piece of territory that ostensibly belongs to another, to the overholding state. So many of our disputes are territorial, so we should think about what territory is, because if we are committed to eventually having a rules-based international order, that is an order where conflict, where disagreements aren't settled by force, we need to have an understanding, a normative understanding, of what the normatively justified rules are. So that's a kind of motivational account for why we should think about territory. So I think this is not really what I think, it's just what lots of people think. There are three important questions of political order and three different common sources of political legitimacy. So first, there's justice, which is a response to the question, what kinds of policies, practices, and principles should be adopted to govern the basic institutional structure, either of our society or of the global order? I mean, you can take your pick. So it's a question of the fairness or justice of policies or principles adopted. A second source of political legitimacy is democracy, which is a response to the question, how should the people be governed? What kinds of institutions should be in place to make collective decisions? And one answer to this question appeals to the people authorizing these decisions through some kind of procedure in which they have input into the rules that govern their lives. So that's a common source of political legitimacy. And third, there's the question lurking in the decolonization literature, who should govern and who should be included in the state? How should the domain of the state, the territory, be determined? So that's really a sort of membership and territory question. In some sense, that question is prior to either justice or democracy because it tells us to whom justice applies, if justice applies in the state, or who should be included in the people who are authorized to make the decision. So that question, what I call territory, is really has two dimensions. One of determining membership in the political community, and the second of determining the geographic domain in which the rules may apply. And sometimes they come apart. And it does both of these things typically with some theorists figuring out the territory first, and then the membership comes out of what the domain is. That is, everybody included in the geographical domain gets to be a member of the political community. So that's one common answer. But other theorists have tried to look at the people first and then figure out the demarcation, where the people should be, govern and demarcate the territory that way. So those are really two common positions. So I've said that there's three questions, justice, democracy, and then territory and membership. And the territory and membership question leads me to talk about collective self-determination as a kind of value. So I think I have to justify self-determination as a separate value which needs to be placed alongside justice and democracy and as important to membership and territory. So I'm just going to try to put in place two cases to think about, to sort of motivate the idea of why collective self-determination might be important. So the case one is an unjust, undemocratic society. So imagine that there is a society, or many societies, which for various reasons, it could be historical, it could be they live in a bad neighborhood, it could be they have weak institutions, whatever the reason, for various reasons, it is neither democratic nor just. Human rights aren't protected, people's civil and political rights aren't respected, and governments rule without being authorized in any way through any recognizable procedure. So this society is neither democratic nor just. And now my question is, would there be anything wrong then if another state comes along and extends their democratic system and their just institutional structure, guarantees rights and freedoms and equality before the law, to the people living in the less just and undemocratic area? That's my question. So I'm trying to say that self-determination would be lost. So suppose this neighboring more just country, which X hypothesized more just and democratic than their unjust and undemocratic neighbor, gains the territory of that neighbor on the grounds that that arrangement will be more just and they will confer equal individual democratic rights. Would there be something lost in that case? And I want to argue that we can't just think about justice and democracy because something would be lost. And that something is at the core of the decolonization or anti-imperial argument. And it can't be fully captured by either democracy or justice, which are common legitimating principles. It's the idea of the people being collectively self-determining themselves. So it's like a hard thing to grasp about collective self-determination because it's less talked about than justice or democracy. So I'm saying justice and democracy can't do all the work. Or let's take another case. This is a case that motivates me. So I'm a Canadian by origin and also by citizenship. And we are taught in school, I'm sure it's a biased curriculum, but we were taught in school that in much of the 18th and 19th century, the United States, our neighbor to the south, believed they had manifest destiny. That is to say, the United States was entitled to rule over the whole of North America. And so the United States thought that they should extend to Canadians, or actually maybe the colonies of Upper and Lower Canada, a right to vote, a right to be sure to vote in American institutions, presumably have representatives in the House of, you know, to the elect members to the United States Senate or House of Representatives, representatives in the Electoral College that picks their presidential candidates. And then the question is, well, if justice is served, they're just as democratic as we are, they're just as just as we are, and you have democratic rights, what would be the problem with that? And what is that extra value which we think might be involved, which is distinct and involves some kind of group self-rule over the territory of Canada amongst Canadians and not Americans? And so how do we make sense of that? So what I'm arguing is that justice and democracy just can't be sufficient, because the point was Canadians wanted their own political project. They didn't want to be Americans. And so the idea that justice and democracy are the only principles just can't be right, I thought. So I have this intuition, which I'm going to try to explicate, that there's something valuable about collective self-rule. I think it's an intuition that many people share, and it's central to the wrong of imperialism. And imperial orders were, to be sure, unjust and not democratic. So they kind of overdetermined the case. But many countries which were decolonized were in unjust and undemocratic states before decolonization, and they weren't. They were maybe in unjust and undemocratic states afterwards, because in a way, if you're in an undemocratic and non-human rights-respecting state, it's a lot to expect that the political culture and political institutions would suddenly be transformed into just and democratic ones. They might be, but they might not be. But I thought it would be it's a step forward to be decolonized, even when it's not clear what the how well the resulting state can manage. So the thought is, I take it, that the people in these places have a right to be collectively self-governing, to rule themselves. And this group right to self-governance is what undergirds the argument against colonialism, imperialism, and the decolonization movement. And I think it's probably connected to a more fundamental belief that there's just something disrespectful in saying to a group that we don't think you have the capacity to rule yourself. That you ought to be in an institutional arrangement whereby some other group or some larger group to which you are a member, to which you're just a component, is self-governing. So I think really at the heart of it is a kind of disrespect thought. So that's my little bit of trying to motivate the intuition about collective self-determination. But then we have to confront what I take to be a problem. And that is, how do we answer the membership? So if you think that we should have self-determination, people will say, well, what is the self that is self-determining? That's the very next question. And there's a kind of problem, because the historic answer to the self-determination question is one we now, I think, rightly find unacceptable. So in the 19th century in Europe, when liberalism and democracy took root and flourished, they were conjoined with another doctrine, which is that of nationalism. Even someone with impeccably liberal credentials, well, maybe not, but many liberal credentials, Immanuel Kant, writing in 1790s, assumed without argument and without explaining how this could fit into the theory that liberal rights and democratic governance would take place in smaller units matching linguistic and cultural criteria. That's what he just assumed it. And the argument that he gave for a state, the idea that you need some institutional order to protect property and rights, that argument that he gave looked like it was going to justify a world government. Like, why wouldn't we just have it everywhere? And then he said that membership in these, that he resists that conclusion. He says, well, not a world state, because as a matter of empirical fact, people are naturally grouped into cultural or linguistic or religious collectivities, and that membership in these cultural groups defines the jurisdictional domain. In other words, the answer to the membership question was always either cultural or religious. And so I have the quote from Perpetual Peace in 1795, where he rejects a world state, and he said, "Nature wills it otherwise than a world state," and uses two means to separate the nations and prevent them from intermingling: linguistic and religious differences. So I think that this cultural and linguistic understanding of how we should define membership, I mean, that isn't just the 19th century. The 1919 Woodrow Wilson principles were premised on the idea of letting the people decide the boundaries of the state, asking, and the question of who are the people was then raised. And the 1919 Paris Peace Accords are famous for determining who were the people, at least in Europe, partly in terms of a plebiscite, which is, the real question is, where's the domain of the plebiscite? Partly by reference to linguistic and cultural criteria, and partly by reference to whether the group was on the victorious or defeated side of the war, with the victorious groups winning some land and the defeated groups not. But the explicit organizing principle was self-government of cultural and linguistic groups. And I think that's no longer an accepted move. Because now that we've had the experience of fascism and also people being excluded from the state, given this, we are no longer so comfortable with marrying ethnic or cultural criteria with the idea of collective self-government. So our question is, how do we answer the membership and territory question, or who the self is that should be self-governing, without appeal to ethnic or cultural criteria? There is also another view we could have to, rather than ethnic and cultural criteria, and that is simply to say, and this is, I think, the dominant thinking now, given that we are not going to use ethnic or cultural criteria, the dominant view now is to say, is partly to ignore the territory question and just make the assumption that, look, the world has states. And is definitional of states, I mean, definitional in the Montevidean Convention on the Rights and Duties of States in 1939, which says states are, by definition, territorial. Right? It's just written into it. So it's definitional of states that they have territory. Look around, there's states, there's political orders, and they get whatever territory they just have. And the idea here is to justify states, and in the process, just justify the possession of territory as necessary to political functions. And this view has been held in international relations, which just assumes that you have states and whatever territory they have is it's true in international law, and it's true in political science and even political philosophy. So political philosophy, for example, has been very interested in the rights and obligations that the state has to citizens and citizens to the state, and ignoring the fact that the state isn't just a membership, it also has a geographical domain, and that just seems to be settled by force somewhere in the past. So the territory of the state is hardly theorized at all. So that has been the dominant view until very, very recently, when there are some people thinking about territory, working on it because they think, well, there's hardly any work on it, right? So so this approach, which is the dominant approach, which is to assume that states are territorial and that we need states, is inadequate. And it's inadequate for both practical and philosophical reasons. And at first, it's maybe the philosophical reason is pretty obvious. This territorial statehood does require a defense. And if it can't be defended, maybe we should reject it. Right? So I'm not trying to defend territory. I'm saying we need to theorize it. And if we can't defend it adequately, we should reject it. So I'll just elaborate a little bit. The existence of the territorially ordered states, which we began at the beginning showing that there's territorially ordered states everywhere, cannot be assumed as part of the natural ordering of the world, and it comes at a cost. In particular, the division of the world into distinct territorial units is challenged by the cosmopolitan idea that views territory and borders as inimical to the moral equality of all human beings. And in fact, cosmopolitans typically object to two features of the modern state. One feature is, so the modern state claims as part of its territorial rights, the right to resources within the territory of the state and the right to regulate borders, those are two rights that they're claimed. And cosmopolitans have argued that there's something wrong about that, that resources should be conceived as part of the common stock of mankind. We're all born on this world. We all have in some sense a right to the resources of the world. So the idea that it's fully controlled by a territorial state and also unequal is deeply problematic. So the idea there is the boundary, that the bounty of the world should in some way be used to benefit everyone. And the state's control over borders is also criticized by cosmopolitans because it seems to violate what we might think of it as individuals' rights to free movement and equality of opportunity. So I'm not going to really assess either of these claims, but I think they're powerful kinds of objections, and they need to be at the minimum addressed. And we need to, and if we are to do that, we need to think about what the justifying principle for state territory and what kinds of rights and the powers it involves, and to what extent it can justify controlling resources and controlling borders. So if I'm going to argue that it's self-determination, we need to know what the limits of self-determination are. And more practically, like less philosophically, some just argue that the territorial state is an outmoded form of organization. So as the world has become more interdependent, many world problems require global responses, which cannot be affected by the system of independent territorial states. And I think this is true of human-induced global climate change and environmental degradation more generally, true of poverty, which is exacerbated by global capitalism, and sometimes a race to the bottom on the part of competing territorial jurisdictions, international crime and terrorism, which many argue require a global response. So on both philosophical and practical levels, a territorial state needs defending or should be rejected. So as it turns out, I'm not really a strong cosmopolitan in that sense. Like, I think these are really powerful objections, but I do think there are obvious benefits to be had from a state applying uniform laws and common policies to people living in proximity to one another, regardless of their status or identity. And I think the territorial state has been essential to the realization, at least in the state, of like equal freedom, equality before the law, predictability, and social justice. So in some sense, I think that is the argument. But that argument is not adequate, because what it does and what is defend a territorial state system, saying, oh, within each territory there can be these things, but it doesn't, unless it can define the precise territory or domain of the state, it hasn't answered the question. It tells us that the order should be territorial, but it doesn't tell us where to draw the boundaries of the state. It doesn't address the question of a boundary dispute. It doesn't tell us what to do in a potential secession. So even though there are sort of arguments for territory, they're pitched at the wrong level. They don't explain these crucial questions. And as I think I began at the beginning saying, we do have these crucial questions, how to define the boundaries of the seceding unit, sort out claims to the seabed, for example, or the high Arctic or Antarctica, which is frozen. We might want to think about the principles on which boundaries should be drawn. And moreover, when states claim rights over territory, they're not just claiming, as I sort of said, rights to jurisdiction over a geographical domain. I mean, they are doing that. But in addition, they're claiming rights over resources in that geographical area where people live and all the way down to the core and above. And the question is, are they really entitled to that? So if we knew what the justifying argument was, we could know whether they were entitled to that. They're claiming rights to exercise control over boundaries and the right to self-defense. And the right to self-defense is also a tiny bit puzzling, unless you think about territory, because an act of aggression in war is not just an act of killing, although typically it involves killing. It's any infraction on the territory of a state can justify a defensive response in what's called just war theory, even when no one is killed by the original incursion. So, that also involves using lethal force just to defend territory. So if we're going to understand that, we need to think hard about what territory is, what can justify it, what elements that justification supports, and how to demarcate different territories to different groups, and all the while avoiding ethnic or cultural criteria. So I'm like putting myself on the horns of a dilemma here. This is actually what I was puzzling about. I didn't want to have ethnic or cultural or linguistic or religious criteria, and I didn't want to think territory just fell out of the statehood because that wasn't going to answer crucial questions. So that's where I'm at in the talk. So now the question is, what is a normative theory of territory? So I'm saying, well, we need a theory of territory, a normative theory of territory. And a theory of territory, I take it, is a theory of the appropriate, normatively defensible relationship between the state, people, and land. Land in the first instance, because I think the other things are analogous or extensions of it, actually. And any theory of territory has to explain how these three elements are related and to justify the particular configuration. And I think that's right because all the theories of territory, extant theories or even partial theories, all do that. Sometimes they put individuals in relation to property and then argue for consent arguments. That's people, land, and then they get the state. Sometimes they have the people forming the state and then creating rules. I mean, they all have these three things in a relationship, all extant theories. So I don't. So I want to argue that I think that those three elements, the state, land, and the people, have to be put into relationship. And I don't think it's difficult to explain the relationship between people and land. I'm going to begin with that. Just think about the losses that a person would experience when they're expelled from the land that they live in, quite apart from the coercion that typically accompanies those events. It's not hard to see that people have very strong interests. And by very strong interests, I mean interests sufficiently weighty to hold others under a duty. People have very strong interests to stay in the place where they reside, where they make their homes, where they have their relationships, where they build their lives. And we ought not to think of only sedentary people as having place-related interests, because nomadic people aren't just roaming around randomly. They also have a particular places that they traverse. They have particular landmarks or particular resources that they're making use of. And so that could claim entitlements to those places. I'm not thinking of it. So that, I think, is the relationship between people and land. We don't talk about it very much. We talk about it in literature, or you can have songs about it. But in political philosophy, there's almost no discussion of it. But yet it seems a pretty powerful kind of sentiment. I mean, in part because we're both migratory creatures, we move, but also we also create homes and place spaces that are our own. And then, so that gives me people and land. And it's not hard to think why people would want to have some kind of collective agency in making decisions over their lives. Not hard to justify why people would want to exercise jurisdiction over the places where they live. And this is what connects people to the state. The idea here is that in making decisions and choices and deciding on the rules that they live under, they exercise collective self-determination. So I'm trying to get all three pieces, those three triangular pieces, into relationship. And with respect to the value of self-determination, although I tried to talk about it with respect to what was missing from injustice and democracy, I think the central picture here is that, you know, sometimes we have a pretty good idea of what injustice is. We know when we see egregious violations of human rights, killing, expulsion, discrimination, ethnic cleansing. But we also feel that there are many legitimate and different ways to organize society that is consistent with justice, at least minimally understood. And there's some value in people making choices collectively with people with whom they're in relationships. They make choices themselves over their lives. And I think that explains why the relationship between people and state institutions and the value that would be realized in exercising jurisdiction together. So that's the three pieces that I want to say. So I still have to answer. I've said, well, let's put these three into relationship, the theory of territory with land and people. But now I actually have to explain who is the self in the self-determining group. Who are the people? How do we appeal to this group-based idea? I mean, I guess the first move is to say that because I'm talking about jurisdiction, jurisdiction is naturally group-based. You can only exercise political jurisdiction as a group. Like, individuals don't exercise jurisdiction as an individual. So it is a kind of group-based idea already. But I want to do so without relying on pre-political criteria like ethnicity or group culture, which might be exclusionary, and I also don't want to rely on the state. And I don't want to rely on the state, as I've said, because if the state is the entity that defines the group, then it looks like the state is assumed, and we're back to that problem. So I want to explore, or I wanted to explore, the idea of a collective entity that is non-cultural and non-ethnic, at least in its definition. But I do think, I do have this sort of idea, underlying idea, that we are not atomistic individuals. So an important part of our moral landscape is that we are in a matrix of relationships that we find ourselves in, identities that we share with others. Many of our interests are interests in collective projects and relationships. So on the idea of being a people, a group does not have to be a cultural group, nor are its cultural features what make it worthy of being a holder of territorial rights. So I found the idea of peoplehood, which is a kind of idea of a people in relationship with other people, helpful. So now the question is, well, what would it be, what would be needed for a group to be a people? And I argue, because I haven't renounced this theory, that three specific conditions are required: political identity, political capacity, and political history. All three of them are a little problematic, so I'm going to just try to, or at least lots could be said against them too, so I'm just going to try to explain them a little bit. So the political identity condition requires that a group is united by a shared aspiration for wide-ranging powers of jurisdictional authority or political control over their territory. That is, they want to be collectively self-governing together. That's a condition. The political capacity requirement refers to predicted and or demonstrated ability to exercise self-determination and maintain effective forms of government. That is to say, it would be difficult to argue that a group A should be given extensive jurisdictional powers if they couldn't, they had no capacity to exercise jurisdiction. It's sort of like just that kind of a condition. I mean, there's much more to be said about that, but. And the third condition requires that members of the group have a history of shared practices and mobilization in terms of political projects. And I think of that last condition as not just predictive of their ability to exercise jurisdiction, but I think I'm also trying to have a political history condition, not saying they have to be in a state, but some kind of political history together, because I'm trying to say that their moral relationships with each other are valuable, so I want to see them actually in a relationship. So that's the reason for that third condition. So they're in a relationship and they want to extend, exercise control over these relationships. So what kind of group would we be thinking of? Well, I think actually many states, I mean, have nation-building projects, so they were trying to inculcate the right kind of identity. They're giving us political histories and capacities. So lots of people that live in states may well be a people. But I don't want to say that it follows from being... So that's what states are trying to do. They're trying to make us feel like we have the... We're in this sort of relationship. But in many cases, I mean, I at least want to leave open the case that there could be a people that doesn't yet have a state, or they don't yet have institutional structures, but they might meet all three of these criteria and be in the right relationship to land so that they ought to exercise jurisdiction. And of course, I guess another caveat is that territory isn't just the territory of a state. Like a sovereign state, like there can be units of a state that are territory too. Or indigenous people might have territory over which they exercise self-determination without being a state. So I think it could be an important explanatory story that culture and language are helpful in mobilizing people and giving people an identity. So it's an explanatory story for why this a group is a people and not some other group. But I don't think it explains, it's not a justification. So I've tried to have a kind of capacious definition for what counts as a people. And that, and so this explains, I think, why it's not okay for the Americans to have manifest destiny over the whole of North Americans, quite apart from the territorial claims of indigenous people there, is that Canadians themselves have their own political project, which may be no more or no less just or no more or no less democratic, but it is their own, and they aspire to be in relations with each other and need to exercise jurisdictional authority to manage that relationship and not be subsumed within an American project. And so this is at the heart, I think, of decolonization, that people are agents and not simply subjects, and that their historical and collective preferences, interests, and aspirations are worthy of being respected. How am I doing for time? Five minutes. Okay, so now I'm going to, this is my last slide. It's because I have 40 minutes. I'm going to try. So the picture that I provided doesn't view land or territory as derived from property. It's not like individuals have natural property and we get this, and we get territory. It takes the opposite view. It justifies territory as a kind of domain of self-determination, and it suggests that people, through making their lives, also create rules, including rules of property, like rules of just transfer, acquisition, and the like. And it views all the rights about territory, like rights over resources and rights to manage borders, have to be consistent with self-determination. That is, you can't get more of that than would be necessary for self-determination. So the justificatory story in terms of the self-determination of a people is what the idea that the rights, that the territorial rights should follow from that. So consider, for example, rights to control borders, by which I mean the flow of goods and people across borders. This is part of the exercise of territorial sovereignty, so we might have to explain this or explain how it's, you know, maybe not exactly as the state claims. But I guess we could say that there's a self-determination interest in controlling borders, in the sense that there may be good reasons why a collectively self-determining group, which has significant forms of control over the conditions of their existence, would seek to have this control. And that's because many aspects of our collective lives, like education policies, healthcare policies and services, are impacted by demographic balance, the rate and flow of migrants, and so on. So it would be difficult for political communities to make collective choices without at least some control over that aspect of the existence. Of course, this self-determination, like individual self-determination, has to be constrained by justice. So there are certain reasons why they can't control, certain unjust reasons. Like it can't be a racist reason, for example. So it doesn't give unlimited control over borders. But you can imagine some self-determination interests in that question. And then consider, too, the idea of resources. So the state claims the right to control resources. And it's usually thought that a legitimate state has control over all the natural resources within its territory. And this is sometimes called the permanent sovereignty over resources claim. Can my account justify that right? Well, I think a collective self-determination does suggest that the state, as a vehicle of self-determination, ought to have some control over resources. And that's because it would be hard to think of a group as having robust self-determination rights unless they exercise some control over land that they live in, the rivers that they fish, swim in, drink the water. And there could be groups in the state that also have rights to control resources, too. But I actually don't see how a self-determination argument, this is a bit of an aside, could justify the full stream of benefit that flows from resources, given that, that's not a question of how we organize our society. I mean, the full suggests that there could be taxation of resource-rich areas to benefit areas that are much poorer, given that we may also have the idea that we all have a share of the in the earth and its riches. So I think that there's the self-determination argument can justify some of those territorial rights, but not to the extent that the current order argues for them, which is essentially like a fully statist account. So just in conclusion, I want to argue what I, for just to sort of suggest, that the account I've given, although it looks like it justifies territorially distinct entities, it is meant to provide reasons, justifications, which also provide limits to those rights, and does so and tries to do so in a way that recognizes the equality of all peoples, so that the argument for territory that undergirds our world also suggests that we need to develop rules and practices so that we can which sort of complements, you know, rules and practices that also take into account this other picture that I think is really powerful and that is a picture that we've all internalized ever since we went to space and then we looked back and saw this little blue planet hurtling through space, and it's a planet on which we all live. Like, we all have to live together in a kind of intergenerational partnership with each other and manage our relationships with each other, which I'm suggesting that we should that we have entitlements to do, and our relationships to land and to resources. So I do want to end by saying that it's not just an idea of a fractured world of territorial units, but a kind of more principled account which you could take into account.
You've been listening to a download from the NYU Abu Dhabi Institute. You'll find more information on our website, www.nyuad.nyu.edu/institute.